Hey Conjurers, I'm Sham.
And I'm Steph.
Ever get that unsettling feeling in parking garages? The one that makes you quicken your pace to your car, glancing over your shoulder, fearing the vulnerability of being alone? If you've ever experienced this, you're not alone. Today, let's delve into the chilling crimes of one man whose actions have etched this fear into the hearts of both women and men alike. Jerome Henry Brudos, also known as Jerry, was born January 31st of 1939 in South Dakota to Marie and Henry Brudos. He was the youngest sibling between him and his brother Larry. The Brudos lived a simple, modest life. His father worked seasonal jobs that caused their family to move around the Pacific Northwest frequently, while his mother took on the responsibility of being the homemaker. Though they looked like the average American family on the outside looking in, behind closed doors they were far from that. This is because the abuse physically and emotionally caused by Marie primarily aimed at Jerry. Marie had always wanted a second child, but her preference for that child was to be a girl. When Jerry was born, she grew to resent him, treated him harshly, and doted on her oldest son, Larry. Jerry had few friends growing up and could be described as unremarkable by his peers. In school, he received the average grades and nothing stood out about him, unlike his popular brother, who was academically thriving. Because of the lack of love that he was receiving from his mother and peers, Jerry sought the maternal comfort elsewhere. He grew close to his neighbor, who was around the same age as his mother, but unlike her, she showed him compassion and acceptance. For a while, Jerry could see the silver lining in his life, until his neighbor could no longer accept visits from him due to her declining health and not wanting to risk further illnesses. The Brudos family eventually settled in Salem, Oregon as their permanent residence. Jerry was known as an odd child. When he was only 5 years old, he began showing signs of having a foot fetish, starting with a high heel obsession. When he was 5 years old, the Brudos family friend's teenage daughter came over. She complained about not feeling well, so they told her that she can go lay down on his bed. While observing her sleeping, he became transfixed on the girl's shoes, a pair of high heels. He tried to take them off while the girl was sleeping, but she woke up immediately and started yelling at him to get out of the room. Shortly after this incident, Jerry went to the local junkyard and found a pair of high-heel rhinestone shoes and took them home. He slipped them on his feet and decided to show his mother. Marie not only made him take the high heels back to the junkyard, she discovered a stash of hidden garments Jerry had been wearing. Upon this discovery, she called him wicked and proceeded to severely beat him and burn all that she found in front of him.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I will step in with this episode is, I'm not going to like this one because I have this thing against feet and foot fetishes.
I mean, yes.
Oh, it's so gross to me. I just can't handle it. But his mother did not handle that in the right way.
No, she didn't handle it well at all. No. I mean, she traumatized him.
He's just a little kid. Made him feel like
shit. Then she beat him.
Yeah. That's just going to make him transfix more on the issue and not break him of it. He's just going to hide it more.
And he's only five. Yes. You know, like, can you imagine? He's That's a baby.
Tiny little baby.
Yeah, no, his mom's not shit. So when Jerry was 7 years old, he attempted to steal another pair of high heels, but these belonged to his first grade teacher. He would later confess that he was trying to steal them, but never gave a reason why. Things were only going to get weirder as Jerry became a teenager. According to Jerry, one of his neighborhood friends with several older sisters allowed him to sneak into their room to view, fondle, and smell their panties. These actions began to turn him on, and it became an addiction, prompting him to steal his female neighbor's undergarments whenever given the opportunity. Jerry was known to be extremely shy around his female peers and had yet to act on sexual intercourse, but that didn't stop him from being intrigued by seeing them naked. In his early teens, he began stalking local women and taking photos of them discreetly. If given the opportunity, he would steal lingerie and footwear. Though he hadn't physically assaulted any of them, he did have fantasies of doing so.
I think his mom's reaction to the high heel thing created a creeper.
I definitely think it did. Because, I mean, let's say he did want to embrace wearing high heels, you know?
Yeah.
She could have...
This is... this level of it is the combination of the original obsession and mommy issues from trauma from the way his mom treated him.
No, I definitely agree. She should have.
It's getting really creepy already.
She could have had a conversation with him if she wasn't for it. You know, like, there were other ways to go about it.
Yes.
Maybe even therapy. Right. Not like him wearing high heels is bad if that's what he wants to do. But, like, it could have been a conversation.
Talk to him about why he's interested in high heels. Yeah. And I don't know. If she's really not okay with it, like you said, therapy maybe. But beating him just turned it into this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, continue.
And girl, it only escalates from here. At the age of 17, Jerry managed to lure a 16-year-old neighborhood girl into his bedroom, where he put on a ski mask for whatever reason, and held her at knife point, forcing her to strip naked so he could take photographs of her. This became a pattern of his, where he would abduct girls who were his age or younger at knife point and take them to his family barn. There, he'd force them to strip naked and be photographed. And Jerry didn't take any accountability for his actions with these women. According to his early victims, after Jerry was done taking photos, he would leave the room momentarily and minutes later appear in a different outfit and hairstyle, claiming his twin brother was the one who hurt them. He would say things like, "He didn't hurt you, did he?" and tell them that he planned to destroy the camera.
Is he disassociating, or does he think he can actually convince people that his twin did it? I think he watches too many soap operas.
I think he was trying to convince them. I don't think he was disassociating. I think he was just trying to convince them. And very himself, clever. I guess. Like,
I don't think anyone would fall for that.
Like, he went to his bedroom, put on a whole new outfit, and then, like, just shook his hair a little bit. And then went to the backyard and was like, "Hey, sorry, that was my twin."
Oh, I'm convinced.
Yeah. He's weird.
All's forgiven.
All's forgiven. Like, what? Oh my God, your twin brother's okay. Shit.
That was a huge escalation from stealing people's shoes to basically kidnapping girls and forcing them to strip down so you can take pictures of them.
And is yeah.
that as bad as that got, or did he only get worse?
And if he's gone that far, he can, you know, possibly go further, right?
That's usually how it goes.
Well, we wouldn't be writing a crime episode if he didn't. So here we are. So eventually, this led to his first offense. In the spring of 1956, his next official victim would be a 17-year-old girl who he persuaded to get into his vehicle to give her a lift home. Instead, he took her to a remote location and brutally beat her because she refused to take her clothes off and let him photograph her. Luckily, a couple overheard her and the assault and called the police. Instead of facing a prison sentence, Jerry was admitted into the Oregon State Hospital for psychiatric evaluation. The diagnosis he was given was that he was experiencing schizophrenia with sexual deviation. The hospital concluded that he had a sociopathic issue that could not be rehabilitated. After 9 months of spending the daytime at school and the nighttime at the hospital, Jerry was released back into society.
I'm sorry. Hold up. He has a sociopathic issue. Mm-hmm. That cannot be rehabilitated, so they just send him back out into the world? That's just like that?
I mean, we see it all the time, dude. People have all of these mental illnesses. This state does not take it seriously, or they just claim to not have the resources and just release them to fend for themselves. And
for everyone else to fend for ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, yes, there's a lot of mental illnesses. You can have schizophrenia and be a completely unharmful person, right? But he has proven otherwise.
Right. He's already assaulted people.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's a fail again in the system.
Absolutely.
Not surprising.
Where did he go from there then?
So after leaving school, he entered the military, but that time was brief. He then became a commercial electrician specializing in wiring jobs. In 1963, at the age of 24, he was living in Corvallis, Oregon, where he worked for a local radio station. This is where Jerry would meet 17-year-old Darcy, who would become his wife and have their first child together.
17? He's like 24. Is that even legal? She's a child.
Well, I did do some research because I was curious. A 7-year gap is pretty huge on top of one being a minor. But prior to 1970, the legal age of consent in Oregon was 16. And that wasn't raised to 18 until 1970.
Ugh. 16 is way too young to be giving consent mm-hmm. to an adult to get married.
I mean, clearly they figured out that something was wrong with that law. Yeah, they,
yeah. Shortly after this, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Shortly after. We could have used it back then, too, but, you know.
Okay, I'm gonna let it go, but
it's still weird.
I don't agree with this marriage.
Neither do I. They weren't the typical married couple, either. Behind closed doors, Darcy was directed by Jerry to do all the housework partially naked or fully naked while wearing a pair of, you guessed it, high heels. This only lasted until their second child was born in 1967. Darcy refused to continue dressing up for her husband at that time, though, and because of this, he used it as an excuse to look to fulfill his needs elsewhere.
Of course he did.
Of course. In May of 1967, he began stalking a woman and chose to break into her house while she slept to steal her undergarments and high heels. The woman eventually woke up to the sound of Jerry rummaging through her heels, but before she could even react, he attacked her, sexually assaulted her, and fled the scene.
So he attempted to assault someone, and now he has actually succeeded at sexually assaulting someone. He just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. What's next? I mean,
oh, he just keeps adding. So in April of 1969, a sense of concern loomed over the city of Portland when 4 women vanished within 15 months. The Portland Police Department was steadfast in their commitment to locate them. On January 26 of 1968, 19-year-old Linda Slauson vanished after last being seen selling encyclopedias in a Portland, Oregon neighborhood. She approached Jerry's seemingly ordinary residence where his mother and 2 children were present, as his wife was at work. Jerry expressed interest and lured Linda into his basement under the pretense of discussing their shared interests. While his children played upstairs, he violently struck Linda on the head with a plank, rendering her unconscious, and proceeded to strangle her to death. Over the next few hours, Jerry treated Linda's lifeless body like she was his personal doll, engaging in the disturbing acts of dressing and undressing her. Around 2 a.m. the following morning, he decided to dispose of her remains. But before doing so, he gruesomely removed one of her feet with a saw and placed it in the freezer, admitting later that he intended to add it to his high heel collection. Tragically, Linda's body was never recovered. Jerry had callously tied it to an engine head before dumping it into the Willamette River.
That's so messed up.
It's very messed up.
That is so twisted.
And he kept her foot as a trophy, like, pretty much.
In the freezer. I don't know about you, but put heels on. I think I'd notice a foot in my freezer.
I mean, this was in the basement. I don't know if his wife often went to the basement. I don't know what she thought that was for.
That's true.
It might be his personal freezer. But definitely. Oh,
that's so disturbing.
It's very disturbing. And to just do things with her after she died, even that takes like that's a different type of human.
I'm playing dress up like that. There's something about that that's really gives me the creeps.
It's very eerie.
Yes.
The Brudos family made a move to Salem, Oregon. On November 24th of 1968, just 3 days before Thanksgiving, 22-year-old Jane Whitney found herself stranded on her way to the University of Oregon due to her car breaking down. Jerry was passing by and offered her assistance, suggesting that he could use tools from his home to fix her car. Comforted by this seemingly friendly demeanor, Jane accepted his offer and joined him to retrieve the tools. What Jane couldn't have known was Jerry's intentions were sinister. Once she was in the car, he opened the back passenger door and attacked her from behind with a strap around her neck, securing it by closing it in the rear door, ultimately strangling her to death. Upon reaching his home, Jerry took her lifeless body to the garage and subjected her to sexual assault. Mirroring his actions with his previous victims, he retained her body for several days, routinely changing her clothes and violating her. Following this dreadful pattern, Jerry chose to keep one of her breasts as a morbid trophy. Eventually, he weighed her body and disposed of it in the Willamette River. He abandoned Jane's car at a rest stop along I-5 between Salem and Albany to divert attention. Her remains were discovered 8 months later in July of 1969.
My God. This is insane. Now he's keeping one of her breasts, which is also really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
He's still doing the whole dress-up thing, which just gives me the creeps.
I mean, he's on a roll with this. He's just like,
he's not wasting any time between.
He's not wasting any time.
You kind of on have March... to wonder how many bodies are in the Willamette River, though.
Well, we'll get to that portion. We'll get to it.
So there's more.
But yeah, there's definitely more. So on March 27th of 1969, Jerry encountered 19-year-old Karen Sprinker in a parking garage at Oregon State University. Karen, a resident of Salem, was heading out to meet her mother for a lunch date. Jerry pulled a gun on her, forced her into his car, and abducted her. Then he transported her back to his home garage, all while his family was in the house. There, he subjected Karen to sexual assault and proceeded to capture photos of her. In a photo that's now available to the public, Karen displays what professional psychologists promptly identified as a look of fear paralysis, a state in which one is completely frozen and unable to move. While Jerry refrained from using his gun, he chose to hang her. During this horrifying act, he took pleasure in the sound of her heels tapping the ground and striking his walls. After, Jerry further violated Karen sexually and made the chilling decision to amputate both of her breasts, intending to create a mold from them.
Ugh, this guy is the worst.
He really is.
We've talked about a lot of killers, but for some reason this case is just really making me almost feel sick to my stomach.
I mean, you know, I always choose the cases that are, like, the most gruesome.
You do choose some pretty bad cases.
Pretty much, I mean, almost all of them are pretty gruesome. So, sorry, guys, if it's a gruesome episode, it's likely my fault. But these stories need to be told, you know?
Absolutely. Regardless. That's true.
We need to know what happened to them. We need to know how sick he is. We need to know how sick people are capable of being.
So, he seems to be doing this even more frequently. There was, mm-hmm. you know, quite a while between victim one and victim two. But then Karen was only 4 months after mm-hmm. Jane. Did he wait another 4 months?
No, girl. Less than a month later, on April 21st of 1969, 24-year-old secretary Sharon Wood had just dropped her children off at the babysitter's and was on her way to work. Later that day, towards the end of her shift, she realized her keys were missing from her purse. Suspecting they might be in or around her car, she asked her coworker to hold down the fort so she can go and check the parking garage to see if she could find them. Sharon sensed someone was following her as she wandered around, unable to recall exactly where she had parked. Jerry approached her and tapped her on the shoulder. He pretended to also be looking for his car and joked with her about being lost in the parking garage. However, the situation took a dark turn when he took out his gun, ordering her to remain silent. Disregarding his command, Sharon screamed, which prompted a struggle. Jerry tried to silence her by placing his finger in her mouth, but she responded by biting down and locking her jaw.
Yes, Sharon is a badass.
The girl was not going down without a fight. Sharon's resistance led to Jerry violently beating her head against the concrete. His attack was interrupted by a car leaving the garage, causing Jerry to run, leaving her dazed and injured. The witnesses in the car called the police, but in a tense statement, Sharon described a tall man with blue eyes and freckles. Sharon was confident that she could recognize him if she saw him again. However, when authorities questioned those nearby, no one could recall a man matching that description.
Well, no one was really looking for anyone in the parking garage. I would trust Sharon, the person who was attacked, to know who attacked her, but also her head did hit the ground, so I can see how they have to take it with a grain of salt. But she is hardcore. Like, she did not know.
Not today. But later we find out Sharon's failed abduction compelled Jerry to modify his approach, becoming more cautious. Fortunately, Sharon survived the ordeal. But tragically, not long after, another young woman would not. 3 days later, on April 23rd of 1969, the disappearance of 22-year-old Linda Saley unfolded. Linda was a secretary and part-time student at Portland State University. She was last seen heading to the Lloyd Center shopping mall in Portland to buy a birthday gift for her boyfriend. When she didn't show up to her boyfriend's celebration that day or work the following day, that raised concerns. It just wasn't like her. Aware that three women had recently gone missing in the community, her parents sensed that something was terribly wrong. They immediately contacted the local police and filed a missing persons report. Linda's car was eventually located at the Lloyd Center parking garage. 17 days later, on May 17th of 1969, two fishermen exploring the Long Tom River discovered the remains of Linda Saley. On the day Linda Saley disappeared, she was walking back to her car at the Lloyd Center Mall when Jerry posed as a security officer and approached her. He started accusing Linda of shoplifting and then forced her into his car and then drove to his garage. There he bound her and left her in a state of fear and confusion while he went to have dinner with his wife and kids.
You have got to be kidding me.
Girl, when Linda was alone, she freed herself from her restraints. But before she could escape, Jerry returned to the garage, caught her, and proceeded to strangle her to death with a strap from a postal bag while sexually assaulting her.
Jesus.
Jerry's actions didn't stop there. He subjected Linda's body to further experimentation, inserting hypodermic syringes at the sides of her ribs and attaching electrical nodes in an attempt to revive her. This only resulted in causing severe burns on her body.
Now he's experimenting with them? This, he has to get worse every time. It's part of his MO as well. He just keeps escalating so quickly.
He adds one more thing.
And now it was 3 days after the previous victim. We have to catch this, guys. He has to be stopped.
And at this point, I feel like he has to be crazy if he thinks he can revive her body.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, I guess we do know that he's crazy, but like...
He's sitting at dinner with his family while there's a woman tied up in his garage. He's clearly crazy.
Are you taking your medication? Like, treatment that still matters, you know? So just 48 hours after the discovery of Linda Saley's lifeless body, a search crew stumbled upon another grim find. The remains of Karen Sprinker. Investigators were eager for leads, and they began questioning students at the university Karen attended. The disturbing truth unfolded as they unraveled Jerry's predatory tactics. He started randomly calling the college dorms, trying to coax young women into going on a date with him. One young woman did agree to go on a date with him, and she recalled Jerry joking around with her and saying things like, "How did you know you could trust me?" and "How did you know I wasn't going to murder you and dump your body in the river?" This immediately alarmed her.
Don't go on dates with men that randomly call your dorm room. Just another I mean, tip.
Let's start there. Obviously, do not go on a date with some random person just calling your dorm. But also, if he starts saying stuff like this, I need you to just get out of the car. I need
Big
you to
red
run.
Flag.
Just
Big
run.
Red flag. Yes, absolutely.
Well, she was disturbed by Jerry's unsettling remarks, but she set up a second date.
She what?
With the police. Gotcha. So the police showed up instead of her and questioned Jerry for his unnerving behavior. Unfortunately, Jerry avoided arrest due to a lack of evidence. But law enforcement did decide to keep him under surveillance. Armed with a photograph of Jerry, investigators interviewed recent victims in the area, including Sharon Wood, who identified him as her attacker in the parking garage. There was also a 15-year-old girl attacked within days of Sharon and Linda, and she also confirmed his involvement.
Yes, now they have him.
And he was trying to go up on a minor? I mean, I guess it's not a huge surprise, right?
Right.
But like...
Well, that's kind of his thing.
I mean, it's
right?
Definitely his thing. His wife was 17. Granted, I guess it was legal.
I'm so glad she survived, though.
Me too. And we're going to skip the details of her attack because she was a minor at the time and... Let's just respect her privacy.
Absolutely.
On May 30th of 1969, the decision was made to arrest Jerry Brudos. However, he and his family had vanished. 3 days later, authorities located his car driven by his wife with their two children in the back seat. Under a sheet beside them hid 30-year-old Jerry. Confident in charging him for the assault on Sharon and the minor, as well as the murders of Karen and Linda, the police commenced their investigation. The discovery of similarities in Karen and Linda's conditions solidified their belief in a single perpetrator. Both were found in the Long Tom River. They were both bound to engine parts and had both body parts missing that were later discovered in Jerry's home. After 3 days of intense questioning on June 3rd of 1969, Jerry finally confessed to murdering all four women, three in his current workshop and one in the basement of his previous home. His detailed descriptions painted a chilling picture of the crimes he committed, including the attempted abduction of Sharon and the 15-year-old girl. While searching Jerry's home, they found the car key and the apartment key that belonged to Jane Whitney. They then searched his workshop of his Salem home that had been made into a makeshift kill room and found numerous photographs behind his workbench. One of the photographs was Karen Sprinker, standing with a blank expression in the nude. Another photograph he took included a mirror, and in that mirror wasn't just a woman that he was capturing, but himself. They found a pile of underwear and over 40 pairs of high-heeled shoes there, too.
Jesus. I'm so glad they caught him. He would have never stopped.
Yeah, no, he definitely would not have stopped. And he just kept, he would have just kept changing his tactics as well, because we saw that. We saw how he progressed over time.
Just getting worse and worse. So tell me they threw the book at him.
So a few weeks later, he was arraigned for the murders of Jane Whitney, Karen Sprinker, and Linda Saley. Due to the lack of evidence and her body not being located, even with Jerry's confession, he was not charged with the murder of Linda Slauson, the 19-year-old who had been attacked while she was out selling encyclopedias. He pled not guilty by reason of insanity in an attempt to get a better outcome at his sentencing. Within days, he changed his plea to guilty due to the overwhelming amount of evidence against him. On June 27th of 1969, Jerry was given three consecutive life sentences to be served at the Oregon State Penitentiary. Jerry died of liver cancer while incarcerated at this facility in 2006.
Good. Look, I know last episode we talked about how we don't really agree with the death penalty, but for someone like this, I feel like he has to die. He has to die.
I might vote that way if I were on the jury.
There's no rehabilitation for someone like this.
He's killed so many women that did not deserve to go. He would have done more.
Yeah, he never would have stopped.
And we're not alone in thinking this. There are other people that were really curious to figure out how somebody could be so evil. Crime scene analyst Rod Englert visited Jerry Brudo's murder room and engaged in conversation with him to delve into the mindset behind his spree of violence. One of the initial inquiries posed by Englert was about the thoughts that preceded the selection of each victim. Jerry disclosed that he would spend hours driving tirelessly searching for what he deemed to be the ideal target. A common criteria for his victims was a woman wearing high-heeled shoes. In a separate prison interview 22 years later, Portland journalist and radio talk show host Lars Larson was allowed to interview 53-year-old Jerry. Larson revealed that Jerry's victims were ordinary women, easily relatable as wives, mothers, sisters, and daughters. The unsettling pattern of these women mysteriously disappearing instilled deep unease in the Portland community, as the possibility of anyone falling prey to such a fate was very possible. Throughout his incarceration, Jerry showed an alarming lack of remorse for the lasting impact he inflicted on the community and the profound heartbreak endured by the victims' families. Larson and Englert agreed to Jerry's apparent absence of conscience, painting a disturbing picture of a man who, given the chance, would not hesitate to repeat his heinous acts.
Exactly as we said.
Like we've been saying this whole time. Mm-hmm. The man is crazy. This story hits close to home for Steph and me. Being Pacific Northwest natives, we feel a strong connection to the community. Although I only recently came across this true crime case, I can't help but think that any of these women could have easily been our friends. They were simply engaging in everyday activities like searching for their keys or going about their work, situations that could easily mirror our own daily lives. It's a stark reminder that tragedy can strike unexpectedly, even in the midst of ordinary routines.
The Missing Persons Support Center, MPSC, is a national nonprofit organization whose goal is to educate the families, public, and law enforcement through training and awareness, as well as methods of prevention. They strive to provide strong and solid assistance to families whose loved ones have gone missing and they are forced to navigate through the system during one of the most tragic times in their lives. They also try to provide a voice for the unidentified in an effort to return them to their loved ones. To get involved and learn more, or simply to look through the missing person flyers, visit www.mpsupportcenter.org or call 636-236-3730.
To view images, information, and sources from this case, visit our website at crimeandconjure.com. Research and writing for this episode was done by Stefan Sham. Editing of this episode was done by Denver Fortner Productions with music by Jordan Alina. Be sure to check out our Instagram at Crime and Conjure Podcast for our question of the week. You can also find us on TikTok.
Sham, what's our conjure tip of the week?
Well, today's conjure tip is just practical advice. A safety tip I employ, especially when I'm not carrying pepper spray. As you walk to your car in any parking lot, in addition to staying aware of your surroundings, consider holding a key in between your fingers. This simple action serves as a makeshift tool, offering a point of pressure that could easily be used for self-defense if you were to face a potential threat.
Such good advice. I always do this.
I definitely do it. I don't care where I'm walking.
That's right. Stay safe.
Something sharp's in my hand. Just as long as you're staying safe and just watching your back, you should be fine.
Exactly.
But a weapon doesn't hurt. Until next time, stay vigilant, conjurers.